And we're live on the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. Frank, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I'm excited and a little nervous. Father of Ari Twitt is on. So I think you're our biggest guest or one of our biggest guests ever. Moses, not to put you on a pedestal, but welcome. And it's good to see you.
I'm happy to be here. I just want to tamp down expectations. hopefully I can live up to that billing. But anyway, thank you very much for having me, guys.
So for those that are involved in real estate Twitter, they're like, oh man, Moses, awesome. For those that don't know who you are, what's your professional life consist of, Moses?
Right now, a lot of sitting around, but up to this point, so I have been buying, renovating, and managing apartment buildings, specifically in Los Angeles for the last 14 years. Over that time, I've renovated more than 100 apartment buildings. Currently own, depending on, what side of the bed I wake up on, between $200 and $225 million worth of apartment buildings in LA. We've also built a property management business, through which we manage our own buildings. So like we had 500 of our own units, then we manage another 500-ish units for third-party investors. And I guess one of the things that makes us unusual is that all of our deals are either contractually or at least sort of in spirit intended to be indefinite or permanent hold. So we're not trying to buy, fix, and flip. We're trying to own good stuff and manage it for the long term.
And I'm curious about your evolution to that business strategy. Was it always multifamily? Was it always LA? Was it always buy and hold? Or has that evolved over time?
So I'll answer that question, but I just want to make clear that it's going to sound like it was much more orderly and well thought out in retrospect, when in real life, as you both know, running one of these businesses, it's just like, what are we going to, like, let's do this. Okay, we did. So it has always been Los Angeles. We've looked at various times in going into other markets. And I think wisely chose not to. It was stupid not to in 2015, 2016, we first thought about it. Then we thought about it again in like 2020, 21. And I'm pretty glad that we did not at that point. So it was always Los Angeles. It was always multifamily. We did a few house flips, which was a terrible business for us for reasons we can go into if you want. The long-term hold thing actually was a combination of having sold a bunch of buildings in the beginning and coming to some, so we sold a bunch of buildings. And then like, I remember looking at the post-tax actual money in our pocket and just being like, what the hell? Like, why did we just do that? Because of things like depreciation recapture and capital gains, and California has horrible state taxes as well. So that was painful. And then I started to get influenced by Buffett and Munger and really start to think about long-term compounding. And then it was like, oh, actually, in thinking about this, we add all this value, we can refinance out all the money and still keep the buildings. And that's tax-free if we do the refinances. So like that just seems like a better way of doing it. And so it was like a series of interconnected aha moments. And then by the time we were, into Adaptive in like 2012, 13, it was like, okay, this is what we're going to do, try to build a big portfolio.
And did you have one solid JV partner or capital partner that came in and shared that? Or was there an evolution where you somewhat training your capital partners, like, hey, this is where I want to go? How did that work?
So the first capital partner that we had, so for my parents put up the money for our first deal. My brother and I bought that together. And then my brother and I did deals 2 through 12 or something together. That was all capitalized by my best friend from high school. And we sold all of those. Then I started Adaptive with my now current business partner. And we for that business, we raised Adaptive Realty Fund 1. half the money. So fund one was like, by the way, like fund one, $3.5 million. It was like a huge fund.
I like it. Those are numbers I could wrap my head around.
it was not Blackstone was not like quaking in their boots at the rise of a new competitor. So half of that money came from friends and family. And to be honest, I don't think any of them cared one way or other about the strategy. It was purely like a bet on me. The other half of the money came from a family office, which became our largest investor, and they are still by far our largest investor. Not my family. but one of the things that distinguishes, I guess, and we can talk about like the genesis of like how I came to various insights in the business. They were extremely important in the development of my thinking. They're a third generation California real estate family, and they've developed and sold a bunch of stuff, but they also have like owned stuff that their grandfather developed like in the 40s and 50s. And these are like obviously fully depreciated commercial assets that are now like just shooting out rivers of cash flow and are worth many, many, many multiples, even in real dollars, are worth many, many, many multiples of what they were, of the original investments. So it was like, that was sort of an object lesson in like the value of holding things long-term and compounding. And so I'm not gonna lie, it's been a struggle. It was a struggle. Now it's a little different now, but it was a struggle for a long time to find other investors who had a similarly long-term focus, but we had them from early on.
Did that create any challenges at the sponsor level on terms of like short-term cash flow in the business, right? Because I'm assuming, refis are great, but like a lot of people's true promotes kick in on sale when all that equity gets pulled out. So how did you manage that process?
It was extremely painful. And in retrospect, in some ways, it continues to be really painful. You can use a promote crystallization clause, which we can talk about if you want, to sort of solve this problem, but we did not include those. So for us, yeah, it was terrible. So the first thing to say is we put in, I think, a total out of the 3.5 or 3.6 million that was fund one, I think we put in, my partner and I put in $110,000. And even that was like a lot for us. Mm-hmm. What quickly became apparent is we were good at doing deals. People wanted to do more of those deals with us. But if we weren't going to sell stuff, then we were going to run out of co-invest money for the reason that you can think of. Like if we're not selling capital, like what are we even talking about?
Right.
So very quickly, we ended up in this conversation with first that family office and later with other investors where we're just like, look, like you guys know that we execute. We care about our reputation. We're not going anywhere. We're trying to build a long-term hold business. We're like actively saying we don't want the money. But so you can trust us to sit there and be long-term stewards, but you can't require us to put large co-invests in because we'll just run out of money and not be able to do any more deals. And so very early on, we established with investors the kind of the principle that we were going to take out considerably more in fees than we were going to put in co-invest. And that's like that's a very unusual situation because of course it runs counter to the skin in the game kind of mindset that a lot of investors have. But I mean, it's just like, look, like you want to do the deals or not? Like we're not playing hide the ball. Like you can see how much money we're making. Like it's not, so that helped. So that's nice. It was sort of chunky cash flow, but it did not meet our cash requirements, particularly as we were scaling the business and we had to hire people internally. We also at the same time decided that we wanted to scale a property management organization. So we were sort of scaling simultaneously two bootstrapped businesses, like an investment management business and a property management business, both of which were subscale. So, and we were like constantly short on cash. Like it was so bad. And it put stress on me personally, my marriage, it was awful. And we did a lot of things like we probably renovated 30 buildings on a fee-only basis where we didn't get equity. We just like someone would pay us like $100,000 to do a gut rehab on a 10 unit building, which in retrospect is like a laughably low fee, but like we were desperate for money. We didn't know any better. So we did a lot of those. We probably made like over the course of, I don't know, 4 years, let's say we probably brought in $3 million in fees from that business, which we then immediately, like much of which we immediately put back into salaries and whatever else to bootstrap the two entities that we were growing. We did a lot of brokerage. I was brokering buy-side deals for people. We then hired some agents and had them brokering deals. So we were basically like doing whatever we could to bring in cash while we were trying to grow our investor base and grow the number of our own deals that we could do.
If you had to redo all, because we're going through the same thing. Like we flipped houses to get our initial co-invests. We had no fees in our first couple of deals. Now we're charging a 1% AUM on acquisition and dispo, but we're still fighting that battle, right? In yep. our position. Because we're not going to refi anything this year, most likely, or sell anything, right? Just the position we're in.
Yeah.
So I really would like to learn from you, like, what would you do differently? Because I think we're doing all the things you said, but I'm like, what else? Like, what would you change?
Well, so a promote crystallization clause would have helped us. One thing that we did, which might be interesting to you guys, is we did some deals with very non-standard terms where we helped organize 1031 exchanges for people. And in exchange, it's probably a little bit too complicated a conversation for this time frame for this podcast, but you can do 1031s and still get ownership, even if it's not your money, by setting up a tenants in common situation. And so you can get paid fees and ownership via a like one of the entities in the TIC that's not the 1031ing entity. So what we were doing effectively is like providing the service for investors who wanted to move from one asset class into multifamily. And as part of that, the economic arrangements allowed us to be first dollar partners instead of being instead of sitting behind a pref to get into the cash flow and return capital, and that takes 5 years and whatever, it's a big pain in the ass. It was like, as soon as this building stabilized, we start taking X percent of the first dollar of free cash flow.
Okay. So you're saying, hey, we're going to provide this service and allow you to have the benefits of 1031. In exchange for that, we take cash flow earlier than we otherwise would have.
And a much lower level. And a much lower level. It's like, we're not going to end up, we don't end up owning 30% of those buildings. We end up owning 7% of those buildings.
Oh, because that's a real trade there. Okay. What is the trigger then for you guys to take part in the cash flow?
On those deals, nothing. Like, in other words, we literally get it from first dollar. So, so it was a conscious trade to like exchange some long-term upside. It's sort of, in some ways, it's a little bit like a promote crystallization clause, because both of them end up with you within a couple immediately after stabilization being like effectively like a real partner in the deal, not sitting behind pref.
Yeah.
Therefore, getting to participate in the free cash flow from very early on. So that was a good model for us. I mean, I think in retrospect, we probably underpriced our services there too. Like, we should have charged, it should have been 10%, or it should have been whatever the number should have been. But again, we were, at the time we were doing those deals, that was a way to, efficiently get access to relatively large amounts of capital, because we were doing such a good, from the investor's perspective, it was like, this is a great trade. Like, they trade out of an asset they don't like into an asset they really do like, with people who, you know, are incentivized to do a good job and blah, 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 and save all the taxes. Like, that was it was very complicated from a structuring perspective. And so I had to learn all this stuff about reverse 1031 exchanges and exchange entities and dealing with title companies. It was very complicated. But it allowed us to sort of solve another problem real estate private equity, like, in some sense, the problem you're solving is the investor, would like to get high returns on the portion of my portfolio that I would like to allocate to real estate. Help me do that. And this is like a related problem, which is, I already have a piece of real estate that I have big gains in and I do not want to pay taxes, but I would like to transfer that allocation to an asset class that I like more. And so it's like a related, but in some ways even much more valuable service, because we were saving them like millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of capital gains tax. So it sort of like served as an unlock for deals that maybe they wouldn't have done with fresh capital, they were willing to do with 1031 capital.
Got it. I like it. I've listened to a bunch of your stuff and I've heard you reference your partner, but I don't think I've ever heard you talk about how you guys look at kind of roles and responsibilities. So Frank and I are partner. We're both thick-headed. We bang our heads against each other constantly. I'd love for you to talk about how you guys kind of divide and conquer.
Yeah. So this guy, John, he went to college with my brother. My brother and I, before we even did our first real estate deal, we started an extraordinarily stupid technology company. And, I won't bore you with the details, but we sort of hired John to do. John had been, he had a background running a college pro painting franchise. And so he was like at loose ends. He wanted to move to LA. We had a job. We hired him. And then when we bought our first building, we needed to do some renovations to it. And neither my brother nor I were exactly like comfortable around with like the whole, with anything to do with construction. So, and meanwhile, John had run painting crews. So he kind of took the lead there. And then when we started buying deals with my friend's money, we kind of hired John as an employee and then eventually a very junior partner. And then when my brother and I stopped doing deals together, John and I partnered up. So in terms of responsibilities, he oversees all of the design and construction management. Which for our, you know, for I guess listeners who don't know, our projects have historically been extremely complicated, and they're both like the worst kind. They're like tiny and complicated, and so to do a lot of them, to put out material amounts of capital, we had to do a lot of them. Like at various points during the last like 12 years or something, I've been renovating between 10 and 20 buildings at a time.
Yeah. Okay.
Like fortunately relatively clustered geographically. So, and near our office. So like in that sense, like controllable, but in another sense, like insanely complicated.
Yeah. Like scaling design is not easy. Like it's harder than scaling acquisitions. Like it's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. And he got, you know, we built relationships with like a good architect, and we had three or four, at our peak, we probably had four different contractors who each had, you know, three or four or five projects. And we were, you know, and we're buying materials for most of those projects. So we have like, we're buying millions and millions and millions of finished dollars of the finished materials. And all of that stuff needs to be separately accounted for. So, it can't, you know, you can't just like, whatever. It's not, it all has to be. It's an extremely complicated problem. So John took responsibility for that. And basically, I took responsibility for everything else, capital raising, acquisitions, and overseeing the property management business and the brokerage. And originally, our economics were 50-50. They've shifted a little bit. But crucially, I think, I have always been the decision maker. And that was something that I learned as a result of doing business with my brother. We were sort of co-managers of the main entity, and therefore we were constantly butting heads, and there was no dispute resolution mechanism because no one could pull rank. So we spent like an enormous, I remember distinctly being outside our first office and like screaming at each other about, I don't even remember what it was. It was must have been something like very inconsequential. We were like screaming at each other, and like a neighbor came out and was like, "Can you guys like shut up?" Like, you know, that level of dysfunction. So when I went into business with John, it was like, okay, like I'm not doing that again. That's a huge mistake. So I'm going to be the decision maker. And that's worked out very well for us. We still have arguments and stuff sometimes, but they're not so poisonous because they're not permanent. It's like at a certain point, a decision can get made. And then paradoxically, that has the effect of like, driving us to collaborate, like, because we all know that I can just pull rank. In real life, I've probably only pulled rank like, I don't know, four times in whatever, however long it's been, you know, 12 years or something. But the fact that I can is very important.
Yeah, it like puts a timer on the argument, right? Because ultimately the other person knows it will eventually end, you know? So like,
yeah, exactly. And, yeah. I, and I, I mean, the part of where that was coming from was, when I was doing business with my brother, I was very conscious. We had taken my friend's money. This was like one of my best friends from high school. We had taken my friend's money. And so I had like staked my personal reputation on raising this capital. And then I had put myself through basically inexperience and idiocy in a position where I was not the final decision maker. And that is a very, very awkward and terrible position to put yourself in. Because like, you're like, on one hand, you're like a fiduciary, you have responsibility, forget about legally, like morally, for this other person's money, but you've signed away the ability to make the relevant decisions. Like that's like I'll never do that again. Right. Like, so when we started Adaptive, I was like, look, I'm going to raise all the money here. I'm going to be the decision maker. At the end of the day, I'm signing every check, I'm signing every contract, all that stuff, because ultimately it's my reputation that's on the line.
Very good. How'd you make the decision to start writing your blog? And, you know, then I think that led into Twitter and eventually to reconvene. Like, what was that nexus to get started, and talk us through that evolution?
Yeah. I mean, so I had a reasonably good network from high school. That's how we got the money from the beginning. And you know, like a network of some people from college, but, my family is, you know, they're a little bit richer now than they were back then, but like not particularly wealthy. And like, I don't play golf. I don't, I didn't have parents' friends who I could call who would write me like $1 million check or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I never had worked in another real estate company. So I didn't even have like a mentor or like even anyone who taught me how to be in the business. And to make matters worse, my first job out of college was in investment banking, but in London. So my professional network, which I sort of, not that it was that great, but like to the extent that I had a professional network from those first couple of years of working, it was in another country. So like, basically I had the list of people to whom I could go for money was very short. So, about that time I read a book. My friend who capitalized deals 2 through 12 or whatever it was, makes us sell all the buildings in 2012. So he gave us some warning. So we kind of like knew that we were going to be moving into a new world where we were going to have to raise money on our own. And around that time, I was reading a lot of stuff, a lot of tech stuff, a lot of whatever. And I read Content Marketing by Seth Godin, it's a little dated now, but it was like life-changing for me. And the premise of Content Marketing is basically that rather than paying, a TV network to allow you to interrupt the basketball game that people are watching with a beer commercial, instead, what the internet allows you to do is to push out valuable educational content. And it's so valuable that to a specific niche of people that they are very happy to give you their email address or other means of contacting them. You then enter into sort of a relationship where you're teaching them and they're happy to be taught, and you're building trust and gaining reputation as an expert. And then when you want to make a sale, it's instead of it being like some intrusive, awful thing, it's like, oh, like we already have a relationship and I know you're smart. And if you're coming to me and asking me to do something, my default setting is that it's probably smart. So I read that book and I started blogging around that time. And because I figured that's how I'm going to meet people. I don't have this network, but the internet's a network. You know, I can just go start writing and hopefully people will come to me. And I also, at the time, there were like a couple of blogs, like Copy Blogger and Pro Blogger. There was like, and that this was sort of like, okay, this is like 2012. So there's social media, but social media has not started to be used to like raise money or anything. But there was an active blogosphere of like professional bloggers who are making money from blogs. And there was like a game plan of like 6 things or whatever that everyone did to build a professional blogging business. And like, if you read Pro Blogger, Copy Blogger, whatever, like they basically all had the same 6 or 7 pieces of advice. And I basically did like a half-assed version that incorporated 3 of the 7 and started doing it. And it was like, it started working. And most importantly, it was like, sit your ass down at the same seat every day and fucking write. And so literally years and years and years, I would come in the office and literally the first thing I did before anything else was for like 15 minutes, sit there and write a blog post. And this went on for 5-6 years. And over time, the readership grew. It never was like huge. It was always like very small, like, you know, single digit thousands of readers a month. But if you're writing a highly specialized blog that's like very specifically about this niche topic, you don't need to have a wide audience. Like everyone who was reading that blog was highly likely to be either a potential brokerage client, a potential property management client, potential investor, or whatever. So it started to work. So I kept doing it.
Yeah. It's like you optimize for conversion, but now you have a big following anyway. So it's like now you got it all going, which is good.
Well, Twitter was basically, you know, I had stopped, we kind of threw the blog, we got much better access to capital by like 2018 or something. I had probably stopped writing on the blog for the most part.
Okay.
And then, but in 2019 or so, like maybe mid 2019, my friend Jim Burden introduced me to finance. He found me through the blog. And he's like, he renovates buildings in Long Beach. So we got to know each other that way. And we're very good friends still. He like introduced me to finance Twitter. And I get on finance Twitter and I'm like, there's some people talking about real estate, but I realized that there probably was an audience for exactly the same kind of stuff that I had been writing on my blog on Twitter. So I basically started doing exactly the same thing I did on the blog, which is to say writing every single day at the same time. And it worked just like the blog had worked, but faster because Twitter has built-in distribution in a way that blogs don't.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone who's not on real estate Twitter that's listening, it's like, I don't know how many people are on it, tens of thousands, maybe at this point, maybe 100,000. It's hard to really pin down, but without it, I don't even know if John and I are sponsors. Like it was that significant for our life. But that leads me to my question, which is like, you're on the Mount Rushmore of our Twitter community for sure. Like one of the founding fathers. Do you feel like a weight to like keep it going? Like, is there pressure to like keep it
especially way it is? With right now kind of being turbulent times with Twitter being a little shaky?
Yeah, I do. So first of all, I should say that it has been enormously beneficial to my life. I mean, we've raised an enormous amount of capital from people we met there. As we talked or John mentioned earlier, I started the conference Reconvene, which is like based on the real estate Twitter community. My new business Reseed is also an outgrowth of my engagement in Twitter. So this has been like life-changing. Not to mention, by the way, I sound so like, leaving aside the mercenary stuff, I've made a ton of friends. Like genuine, you know, probably lifelong friends and business partners and stuff from Twitter. So it is totally been life-changing for me. And do I feel a responsibility? Like, kind of. I mean, I don't know how deep in the weeds you want to get on this, but Twitter, because of the nature of how the algorithm works, it rewards incendiary posting because people, you post something incendiary, people start arguing about it. It shows it to more people and you get a following through that. And that's, you know, it is what it is. Like that's how Twitter works. And the problem is that we are at the same time trying to have this community that where we are, even though, you know, I don't know. I don't mean like you guys and I don't know you guys that well personally, like we may have very divergent views about politics, about religion, about who the right way to live, like, you know, all that stuff. We have this really cool common interest in real estate. And so the community is awesome. There's all these people who want to talk about this stuff, that exactly the stuff that we want to talk about. But meanwhile, you get this algorithm that is prioritizing, you know, fighting and arguing and all that stuff. And so there's a lot of tension between the two of those things. And so no one put me in charge of anything, but I do feel at least some, to the extent that people listen to me, I would like to urge them not to do, even though it's tempting to do the incendiary thing because you are rewarded with likes and followers and all that stuff. I regard that as being fundamentally fairly damaging to this community that we have developed that is so valuable to all of our lives, because it tends to tear it apart, right? Like, I start posting incendiary political shit, it forces you to take a position, you know, Moses, you're full of shit, you know, blah, blah. And suddenly this community that's been so valuable turns into, oh, now we're going to have liberal retweet and conservative retweet or Christian retweet and non-Christian or whatever. And it's just like, ah, like that doesn't serve any of our interests. So I do feel some responsibility to push back against that.
Yeah, I agree, right? It's also, as a competitive guy, it's tough, right? It's tough because I want a million, I want 10 million followers. And, you know, people do threads about like, hey, if you post this crazy shit, it'll work, you know? So it's tempting, right? But I think one thing, I want you to talk about Reconvene some. And the way I'll connect it is, one of the things that gives me confidence not to go down that route is how many awesome people we met at Reconvene, and knowing that the people reading my tweets aren't random unknown people. Like, they're actual people that we've met and we've had dinner with and we've talked to on the phone and met in person.
Yeah. And I think I want to emphasize to people who are on Twitter, who are listening to this, I can't stress enough, Twitter is trying to get you to play the follower and like and views game. And I'm guilty of it too. Like, obviously I look at that stuff. That's not the game. The game is follower, is audience quality. Like, there are people, and we got a $20 million check from someone we met on Twitter. Like, that's the stakes. The stakes are enormously high, right? So if you are focused on playing the follower, you know, likes, views game, if you do that in a way that causes serious people to think that you're a clown, you will never have that conversation with the guy who can write a $20 million check. Those two things are antithetical. And so I think it goes along with what you said about Reconvene. It's like, no, there are real people who are really doing deals, really writing significant checks. And you want to optimize, in my opinion, for getting the attention and building relationships with those people, not how many random bots or anonymous trolls you can like roll up into a following.
Very good. Where do you see Reconvene going, right? From where it started, how it's evolved, you know, what's 10 years from now, if it's executed exactly how your vision wants it to, where's it go?
Yeah, good question. So let me describe where it is now, and then we'll, you know, so right now, roughly, we cap it at 300 people. We'll see, probably be around there this year again. The last 3 years it's been in LA, the event, we call it like a real estate unconference. So it's like 2.5 days of hanging out with other real estate operators and passive allocators in a bunch of different contexts, formal talks, informal dinners and lunches and hanging out on the beach and parties, whatever. And the idea is like really get a chance to make some relationships that hopefully are going to move your business forward, whether in the form of new ways of doing deals or thinking about things or whatever that you learn from other operators or getting checks from capital providers. Like that's kind of the concept. As to what it'll look like going forward, like, I mean, in a dream scenario, and this is going to take a lot longer than 10 years, my friend Sam Hinkey was like, you should really think about this like Allen and Company thinks about the Sun Valley Media Conference. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but like, that's like the, you know, Rupert Murdoch, Mark Zuckerberg, like you name it, like the absolute biggest names and in most powerful people in media get together and like make deals that change the entire world. So that's like what you could aspire to over a very long period of time. How we get there and what the event looks like as we try to get there, don't know. Like we're going to be led to some extent by the audience. And I imagine we'll probably experiment with other geographies, maybe on the East Coast, maybe a cool vacation place in Montana. Maybe, I don't know. Like maybe we'll go up in wine country in Northern California. Like we don't want it to get stale from an experience perspective. And we want to also make sure that we're bringing in new faces. Like it'll get a little stale if it's the same 300 people every year. So you want a fair number of repeat people, but you also want to constantly be bringing in new people to kind of, so for obvious reasons, So I don't know. I honestly don't know, but we're focused on doing a really good job for this year. We have some thoughts about what it's going to look like next year, but the true north of it is really like, look, this is a solitary business, or can be a solitary business. You generally don't want to spend a lot of time talking to your like closest competitors, because that's weird. But we all benefit from talking to other people who are going through the same stuff we're going through, or like went through it 2 years ago, or are going to go through it 2 years from now. That is a very valuable network to have. And we're going to try to continue to enrich that network.
And hopefully continue to have awesome tacos. Every time I have tacos, I'm like, these are good, but they're not as good as the Friday tacos we had at Regis.
We hired a guy who's like the world's leading expert on Los Angeles taco trucks to come in and pick up.
I also want to give you credit for having awesome panelists and guests. I saw someone speak about $1 billion 1031 last year, which I was never aware that even existed, but yeah, apparently it does.
And by the way, like, credit to Jay Szyminski for being willing to be open about that. And also credit to Nick Huber for like pulling it out of him. Cause Jay is one of the most impressive, maybe the most impressive real estate operator I've ever met. Just like a fucking dynamo of energy. And I mean, you guys should try to get him on the podcast. A lot more interesting than me. But he can be a little bit reticent in talking about it. He's like, he's a private guy and he uses his own money. So he doesn't raise money from anyone else. So he really doesn't have any need to go out and make a name. It was purely because he thought Retweet was a cool community and was willing to help out. And because Nick like really did a good job of kind of pulling that information out of him. That was freaking awesome. That was pretty good.
And it was awesome. Just as a reconvene attendee, he has gone back and forth with me since then. The idea that I could have access to someone like that is kind of mind blowing. So another plug.
Totally. And by the way, like, I mean, he's in Los Angeles, but in a million years, I would never have met him without Real Estate Twitter. Like, that's how powerful that the network is. It just breaks down all those barriers in some ways it's like a luck machine or like a novelty machine. It's like, instead of getting set into the same people that you see at your golf club every day or at the same ULI meetings that you all go to over and over, it's just like it exposes you to this huge potential audience of friends and partners and investors and all that stuff.
Right. So when we initially reached out to you to come on the pod, you were like, hey, let's do April because I've got something big coming. Now we know it's reseed. So can you talk to us about that and, you know, the genesis of it and kind of where you are now and where you hope to go long term?
Yeah. So, I mean, the short description of reseed is that we're trying to be like a Y Combinator for real estate GPs. And the longer answer is like, I went through the crawl across glass period that we talked about earlier that you guys are currently in. Okay. So I recognize that there are issues, there are problems that beginning GPs go through that cause them to deviate from the optimal path. Like, if this is the optimal path for building a very large GP business, you can sort of get sucked into doing this or this or this because you need cash, because you don't have the right market knowledge, because you need to strip cash out of your business so you can't reinvest into it to build the kind of systems and processes and technology that you need to grow. Like, I've lived that. Obviously, you guys are living it now. Like, it's a problem. And then my partner, Rhett, had been on the allocator side. And there's a really interesting problem on the allocator side, which is the following. If you are a pension fund and endowment who doesn't pay taxes, it is very easy to write a check to Blackstone or whatever. They do deals that maximize IRR, which means buying, fixing, and selling. You don't care about capital gains tax because you don't pay it. So maximizing IRR turns out to be a great strategy. But there are a huge number of people, high net worth and family office investors, who pay taxes and are therefore very sensitive to the after-tax nature of the returns, not the pre-tax. And yet they are being served up for the most part by GPs deals that are maximizing IRR. Like, that's how everyone learns to present deals. Like, you guys know, like, you call an investor and you're like, I got a deal. They're like, what's the IRR? And that causes you to or to choose deals that are going to be able to max IRR, that you chooses you to capitalize them in ways like with debt that that maximize IRR, that causes you to sell quickly. Like it there's a whole bunch of behavior that's downstream from maximizing IRR. And so, but if you're a tax-paying investor, you're like, we don't want you. You got a good asset. Like, we don't want you to sell that. We want you to manage it and capitalize it conservatively and let the free cash flow come back to us and let it compound over time. And okay. So we believe that, so Rhett in his experience in Allocator found that it was very hard to put together a portfolio of deals that were structured like that for goods selected and structured for long-term holds for tax-paying investors. And so so he came to me with the idea and said, look, like, why don't we go? We don't like what the different restaurants are serving up to us in terms of food. Let's go train our own chefs. Let's go take some operators, teach them to do the deals that we do deals of the type that we want to do, structured in the way that we want them structured. And then let's help them, let's teach them, and then let's remove the impediments to them growing big businesses, providing those kind of deals. And then we will make our money by raising money from these tax-paying investors and allocating it to those deals. So it's putting these, you know, cohort after cohort of operators out into the world and then capitalizing their deals and then making a fee on the LP capital that we provide to them. So it's a very complicated business, but I think it actually is it's a novel way of aligning incentives in a way that I think is going to be really, really appealing for all of the constituents.
Got it. And are you guys injecting operating capital, or is it just as well, or how's that work?
Yeah. Without getting like really far into the weeds. Yeah. We're going to, so one of the impediments to starting in this business, as you guys know, is like, how do you live while you're trying to search for your first deal or while you're doing your first couple of deals? Like, hopefully you have a spouse who's earning some money, or maybe you've saved up, or maybe you come from a rich family or whatever. But this was a hypothesis before, but now that we have a bunch of applications, I think it's confirmed. There's just a lot of people who have been an analyst at serious real estate shops, you know, for 4 or 5 years, who really know how to go find deals, but who are not in a position to go off on their own, in part because they don't have enough of a bankroll, and it's risky to do that, as you guys know. Money to pay for a sort of a small but livable salary for the first year, deal pursuit costs. We're going to be willing to put up to 100% of the GP co-invest. Because we talked earlier in the conversation about like that problem of like, you have to put money into the deals, but we want the fee balance to be the way that we have it at Adaptive, where they're getting out more in fees than they're putting in co-invest. We like these deals. We'll take the co-invest.
That's big. If anyone's listening, that's like thinking about being a sponsor, deal number one, you don't even notice this stuff, 'cause you're like, doesn't matter, I'm just so happy to be doing this deal. By deal number four, you're like, oh shit, this is, I got to get paid, yeah. Right? W-2 spouse for the win, right? So I got a good W-2 behind me, thank God.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I mean, my wife at the time was working, so I was just like, I mean, it was terrible. Yeah. So we're providing. So from a purely financial perspective, it's salary, deal pursuit cost, GP co-invest, and then crucially, where we are going to make our money, the vast majority of our money is. Basically getting a right of first refusal to do some or all of the LP capital, and then turning around to these like gigantic families that want to put out $100 million or $200 million and build like a diversified portfolio of long-term holds. On a deal by deal basis, we'll have those families capitalize the deals that these operators find.
So as you think of the different structures of that business, and as you said before the call, you guys are doing a little bit of offsite and putting your heads together right now about this, but where's the friction? What are the limiting factors? Some of that'll come through trial and error, but as you guys think about it right now, what's going to be the hardest thing to get it up and going?
Well, so one of the cool things about the founding team, like Rhett brought me in, in part because of the reach that I have on Twitter. So there's like with any new business, there's a series of hypotheses, right? Like we think this, but we don't know until we get in business. One of the hypotheses was like, that there are a bunch of people who might be interested in a deal, in taking a deal like this from us, a bunch of operators. And so when I posted on Twitter, and I want to say specifically to everyone out there in retweet who like retweeted it and talked about it, and like that was amazing because the reach was enormous. We 550,000 people have seen that post. We got 1,500 interested people, which led to hundreds of applications. And we've basically validated that there's a bunch of really talented people, people who I would have no problem backing to do deals, who are interested in taking a deal of the type that we're talking about. So that was like, that was one friction point. But there are other friction points. It's like, how do you train them all? Like, everyone's used to doing stuff their own way, but if you're going to have five and then eventually 20 and 30 and 40 operators out there sourcing deals, like, how do you control that? How do you underwrite the deal as they bring a deal to you? How do you decide like whether you should do it or not or whatever? So there's a whole bunch of systems that have to get built and procedures around what does it look like? How do you present us with a deal? How do you underwrite? How do you present it to us? What's in the deal memo? What's not? Like, then there's a whole bunch of legal stuff like, what is the legal relationship between us and the operators? What is the legal relationship between us and the investors? And there's various different flavors of investors. So it is an enormously complicated business. Fortunately, it's not just Red and me. We have other teams. We raised some money into the operating company itself, into Reseed itself, from some very high quality investors that is allowing us to pay salaries for a team for Reseed. It was all impressive people who are working on all this really complicated shit that we have to do under the hood to be able to make the hopefully make the magic happen.
And who is like the perfect sponsor or sponsor team? Like what's not enough experience? What's too much experience, if that's a thing? Like, how do you guys nail that down?
Well, so this is another hypothesis, right? It's like we could have a series of hypotheses about what sorts of people might be successful, but until we actually go out and do it, like, what the hell do we know?
Right.
So right now we think, we've seen a lot of applications now. So the best ones so far seem to come from people who have worked at other real estate shops, like for a salary, like aren't a partner, but are people who have actually done some deals on their own, but are running into exactly the problem that you guys are talking, that we've been talking about, where like, how do you make the money work? Who are like, hey, I want to accelerate things. I would like some mentorship and this capital arrangement that you're talking about to really like, let me grow the business. We think that there are a bunch of people who are in like the brokerage business, who have either done a deal or two on the side or come close or whatever, who know enough, who aren't just intermediaries, who actually like have a demonstrated desire to get onto the buy side, who are proving to be interesting applicants. We also, there's also sort of a set of people who don't work in real estate at all. Like maybe they work in tech or whatever, but who have bought deals on the side, who are proving to be quite interesting as well. So that was a long answer, but I want to repeat again, like we have some ideas about what's going to work here that it totally remains to be seen whether those ideas are correct. And fortunately we've raised enough money that we can go through several cohorts and sort of start to get some better testing of these hypotheses and then start to get a better sense for what the right operators look like.
I think it's exciting. And there's a lot of stuff you're putting out that I think is exciting, but this might be the most exciting. And I think checking in 3, 6, 12 months is going to be great. I want to be respectful of your time, Moses. One of the questions I want to get from you is, what are you doing to learn these days? What are you reading? What are you listening to? How do you make sure you're staying sharp?
I mean, honestly, real estate Twitter has sort of become the dominant way that I learn stuff. What happens is, I'm sure you guys are experiencing this yourselves. What happens is early on, it's useful to like read real estate books, you know, like, in my business, Multifamily Millions, great book, kind of cheesy, but like really good about, value add multifamily. And what happens as you get further into the business is that your problems become much more specific. Maybe like, what should a promote crystallization clause look like? What is like, oh my, yeah. What is
this? Like, it's like, too specific to sell books, right?
Like, yeah, you're not going to, yeah, exactly. Right. The audience of people who are interested in promote crystallization clauses for real estate is probably like under 10,000 in the whole country. But, and I didn't even know what that was. I happened to be sitting with my now friend, Kendall, from, I met from Real Estate Twitter. We happened to meet up YPO together. So we met up in, I think this was in Chicago. I can't remember if it was Chicago or Miami, but we were sitting there and we were sort of both bitching about how broke you are in the beginning before you sell anything or have any major refinances or whatever. And he was like, well, we have this promote crystallization clause. And I was like, what the fuck is that? You know, and it turns out that's an extraordinarily valuable piece of technology, but you're not going to find that in some general interest book, or even like, even a niche book is not going to be that nichey. So it turns out that for me, and this goes back to the conversation we had about Reconvene. It's like, at this point, the people who I need to learn from are like talking to Chris Powers, who's like younger than me, but, you know, has five times the AUM and has been doing this for a really long time and has solved a lot of the problems that I'm wrestling with now. And I think for you guys, talking to me and other people who are like, you know, a little bit ahead of you, but maybe not necessarily Chris Powers ahead of you is valuable. So I think it's a long way of answering. Mostly the learning is one-to-one or interactive.
It's a great answer. Let's cut it off there. Anything else you want to point people to, or feel free to promote anything you want, Moses?
No. I want to promote you guys.
Well, thank
no,
you.
I think you know, you're doing exactly the right thing. You are going through exactly the process that everyone who tries to build one of these businesses goes through. The kind of quiet period maybe that we're currently in is really painful for everyone across the business. It doesn't matter if you're Chris or me or you or anyone in between or starting out, like, this is tough for all of us. A recession may be even tougher, and that's scary too. But I will just say that you guys are walking the path, like, and, you know, we'll see how far you walk on it and how far you get and everything. But I just want you and everyone else listening to this to like not be discouraged by this period. The periods where you can grow, periods of chaos and downturns and disjunction and whatever, those are opportunities. And we just sometimes it feels hard as a human to sit there because it might be a year that you're waiting doing nothing. But those periods come, and that's when people like level up. And so it's coming. You're doing exactly the right thing. You are maintaining the trust of your investors so that they're there to back you when things get really interesting. And who knows when that will be, but that's what you get. That's the game, is maintaining that reputation and that credibility such that when it's time to play offense, you can play offense. And that's what you guys are doing.
Thank you.
That's, you're the man. Yeah,
that's really great. You said that. Thank you. I appreciate that a lot. That's it, everybody. Let's thank Moses for coming on the pod, and we'll see you guys next week. Thank you, Moses.
Take care, guys.